Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Writer, historian, and activist Rebecca Solnit is the author of more than 20 books, and now in her first long-form book in nearly a decade, titled Recollections of My Non-Existence, Solnit reflects on her youth and how she found her voice as a writer and a feminist. She vividly details moving to a place she could afford in San Francisco in the 1980s, where she made important connections in her life with the local punk rock community and artists as she figured out who she was. She thrived in the city and tried her best to survive despite the everyday threat of violence and sometimes erasure. As she writes in her book, I'm going to read this, Rebecca. I was told to move someplace more affluent, though some of the most malevolent harassment occurred in such place, to cut my hair, dress as a man, or attach myself to a man, to never go anywhere alone, to get a gun, learn martial arts, to adapt to this reality, which was treated as something as natural or inevitable as the weather. But it wasn't weather. It wasn't nature. It wasn't inevitable and immutable. It was culture. It was particular people in a system that gave them latitude, looked the other way, eroticized, excused, ignored, dismissed, and trivialized. Changing the culture and those conditions seemed to be the only adequate response. It still does. Tomorrow night at 7:30, Rebecca Solnit will be in conversation with Leslie Jamison at the Community Bookstore event at Murmur Theater. Rebecca Solnit is in my studio right now. Rebecca, it is so nice to see you.
It's so lovely to be here. Thank you so much.
Before we dive into what's inside the book, I want to talk about the cover.
Okay.
So there's this photo of you, and your back's to the camera. You're up against a wall. You're sort of looking over your shoulder. You've got a sort of a 40s type hat with a net mm-hmm. over the front and mm-hmm. and evening gloves and a black dress. What's the story behind this photo?
It's me wearing what I still wear a fair amount, kind of thrift store vintage consignment clothing. It's the skirt from a 1940s suit without the jacket. What looks like a top is a men's low-cut vest turned backwards so that it's low-cut in back instead of front, and a very cheap pair of satin evening up-to-the-elbow gloves. But I'm against the wall in the apartment that's one of the central characters, in a way, in the book. And it was taken by a man I wasn't that comfortable with. So it's a funny picture of a very, very young woman, both trying to appear in her dress-up glamour and trying to disappear as I'm trying to sort of like turn away and melt into the wall. And that's so much that conflict that this book is about, wanting to appear and to be somebody and wanting to disappear and feeling like nobody.
Did you know where this photo was, or did you have to go digging for it?
Oh, well, you know, I've never really put together albums, so I had a big box of photos, and I knew it was in the box. We went through a bunch of photos from me from this era for the cover, and at a certain point, it became clear that this was the picture.
You write in your book, memoirs at their most conventional are stories of overcoming, arcs of eventual triumph, personal problems to be taken care of by personal evolutions and resolve. But this really isn't very conventional in terms of the way it is written. It's how would you describe it?
Well, someone called it an impersonal memoir. I have a very peculiar trajectory. That's my life story of becoming a writer, which means spending more time alone than normal people could stand and being self-employed and scraping by until I did a little better. Mm-hmm. But I also have a deeply ordinary and typical story, which is that I'm a woman who lives in a world where violence against women is epidemic. And during those years of this photo that this book is about, it made a huge impact on me. And so I wanted to write about my experience because it was ordinary, not exceptional. And as you bring up, I also wanted to convey something very different than most memoirs do. We're taught to tell our stories as personal stories. This happened to me, maybe, but it made me exceptional because it was worse than what happened to other people, as a lot of memoirs have. And then this is what I did to overcome it. I left my abuser. I went through some sort of transformative process to overcome trauma. But a lot of my point in this book is that this stuff is ambient. Just because it hasn't happened to you doesn't mean that it never will. The fact mm-hmm. that it happens to people who are in your category, as with racist violence, homophobic violence, trans violence, means that it's never really gone. And I didn't want to, I couldn't leave it behind because it's everywhere on earth. And there's no reason why I should reconcile myself to something so dehumanizing, so in violation of the human rights of half the people on this earth. so destructive. And so then the only solution is collective change, which isn't which I think actually there's probably a lot of memoirs about racism going all the way back to Frederick Douglass and things that are actually like, well, we just need to change everything. And there are some feminist memoirs that do that. And this is definitely one where it's like, I can't personally overcome it. I can't reconcile myself to it. So like, let's change the world.
There's so much description. This is what I think is interesting because I read a lot of memoirs.
Yeah.
There is a linear line because it's telling your life, but there's also just so much description about everything around you, but we learn a lot about you by the way you describe and experience things around you.
Well, that's another way in which I sometimes think that the most memoir-like things I write are also anti-memoir. Not only do we learn that it's our job to personally overcome all the bad things that happen to us, even if it's structural, racism, economic obstacles that are not our personal failures, but also we learn to tell stories as though we're very isolated, individualistic beings. We are all the stories we heard and believe, both the ones that are prisons and the ones that are wings that let us fly out of those prisons. We are the people around us who impact us. Mm-hmm. And the violence against women close to me and women in the newspaper stories and everything else impacted me hugely. So I also have always tried to tell stories in which I'm not separate, in which I am shaped by all the things around me in which I participated in and in some way, so that there's a much more fluid sense of self, both in how you flow out into the world and how the world flows into you. So thank you so much for noticing that.
You begin the book at age 19 and you move into a studio apartment in San Francisco in the 80s. What drew you to this particular apartment?
Well, it felt like a really great place to start. It's the week after Ronald Reagan was inaugurated, which means that the beautiful economy assembled by the New Deal and the Great Society and all these progressives had just begun to be mm-hmm. seriously dismantled nationally. But also, this is a book that's immensely and intensely about violence against women. But it begins with a really wonderful man who I'd wanted to pay tribute to a long time before this book took shape. I was so impoverished. My parents had cut me off years before. I was 19. I was in college. I was looking for a place to live. And unsurprisingly, to people who know how cities work, I ended up in a black neighborhood mm-hmm. as an affordable neighborhood, not quite knowing what I was doing. But this wonderful black building manager made it possible for me to move more or less illicitly into his building, Mr. James V. Young from Oklahoma, World War II vet. And so the book really begins with this giving of refuge by a complete stranger. And this incredible gift, because I spent 25 years in that little, beautiful but small studio apartment, and that became kind of the Nautilus shell in which I, you know, formed myself, the place mm-hmm. in which I went from being somebody who wanted to be a writer to somebody who'd published many books, somebody with no friends to somebody with some wonderful friends, somebody with no voice to somebody with a pretty audible voice. And it was all a gift from a stranger, which I think is such a magical thing.
Mr. Young, hearing you describe it and reading it, sounds like he was sort of a prototype of what an ally should be.
Oh, he was this amazing man, a farm boy from, you know, growing up who got drafted, had a military career, had been in this building for many years before I came along. And like many of the older black people in this neighborhood, was part of the Great Northern Migration mm-hmm. and brought a lot of kind of country ways, unhurriedness, talking to strangers, knowing everyone in the neighborhood. And then was also, you know, very much a city guy in other ways. In those overalls was often a pistol tucked I'd catch sight of sometimes. And but he was so kind and protective to me. And, you know, my life might have taken a very, very different turn if not for the fact that on Super Bowl Sunday, 1981, a black man not watching football but watching the Blues on TV decided to really go out on a limb for a weird little white girl who came wandering along in search of a home.
He figured out a way that someone else could sign the lease for you.
Yeah, and then he covered for me for several years until they figured out that the person, and I was faking, it was my mom who normally never went out on a limb for me, but I got her to do this one thing. Right. And since she was probably the most financially impressive candidate for this little apartment they gave it to her without thinking, why would she, this homeowner in the suburbs, actually want it?
Right.
And then I faked her name, and it's another kind of non-existence. I did not legally exist in that apartment for the first 8 years there. My name was not on, it was my money, but not my name on the checks. And he covered for me. And it was that, I think people who are used to living on the margins, who, as poor people and black people so often do, saying, like, to survive, we're going to just bend the rules a little bit.
That used to happen a lot. Sometimes you would get a white family to buy a house for a black family and then sign it over in the middle of the night. It was the way in a lot of communities, a lot of cities, that used to happen.
Yeah. Well, this is a funny reversal where a black man kind of, like, lets a white woman sneak in. And it was such a gift. And it's also just so interesting. There's a line by the philosopher Foucault my partner likes to quote, you know what you do, but you don't know what you do does. He knew he gave me a place to live. He died 8 years after I moved in and didn't know I would be there for 25 years. And that affordable rent, thanks to the city of San Francisco's rent control policy pushed by, you know, tenant activists, gave me a space in which I could quit my post-college job and just really scrape by and be precarious as I got it together as a writer until, you know, it started to pay off a little bit better and a little better. And then I moved, and now I live across town. But that place was such a deep part of me, too. It's still so in my psyche and still something I'm grateful for as a gift.
My guest is Rebecca Solnit. The name of her new book is Recollections of My Non-Existence. What was it about San Francisco at that time that really helped create a foundation for you?
I was a weird kid. I was a girl in a family of boys. I was in a liberal, half-Jewish family in a conservative, sometimes anti-Semitic neighborhood, in an anti-intellectual town. I was always kind of a weird misfit. And San Francisco still is a really diverse city, not like it used to be, because gentrification is its own sort of border patrol. But it was full of people who had been outsiders in many ways, people for whom English was a second or a fifth language, non-white people of, you know, huge Latino and Asian populations. It was it's been a white minority city for, I think, most of my lifetime. It was the queerest city in the States. And one of the things I write about is how just the way black people talk to strangers and banter taught me to talk. In some ways, what a pleasure and joy and really craft just saying hi to somebody could be. And then gay men were also just such a magical gift to me. Also in some of the generosity and playfulness and wit in how they taught. I feel like they taught me how to talk, but also how they modeled, if I refuse my gender assignment, if I refuse the rules of masculinity, then even you, straight girl, can reject the rules of femininity. You don't have, you know, you can reject the rules of family, because in those days before same-sex marriage rights and more open adoption rules, chosen family was such a powerful thing. And the idea that just these people who were friends could be as strong as any other human connection you could have. And I think that's still a strong presence in urban life and queer life, and that was huge for me. So the city was a place where everyone belonged, because, you know, there was room for everyone. I did three atlases later, starting with San Francisco and then New Orleans and New York, and there were also celebrations of cities as coexistences of innumerable versions of what a city could be, innumerable stories, innumerable lives. And I had a sense of that, and I was a walker in the city. The gender violence, the street harassment in Menace I write about, impacted me so much, because all I wanted to do was just to roam around night and day, see everything, look at everything, go everywhere. And all the people who are perfectly willing to accept that I should basically never leave the house alone were making me so crazy, because I wanted to be free. I wanted to be out in the world. I wanted to be a witness. I wanted to be in dialogue with everyone. I wanted to wander and never stop. And in some ways, I never did. But in so many ways, I was impacted by the terrible threats against me as a young woman that exist for almost every young woman. And also, you know, sometimes for other kinds of people, there are other rules around race and sexual orientation, about who can go where and who's safe. but the violence was just such, is so much what this book is about, and it had such a huge impact.
Could we get you to read a bit? We discussed a piece from the chapter Life During Wartime.
Just that one paragraph?
That'd be great. Or if you want to set it up, explain to people where it is in the book.
And one of the things I really wanted to say is that, again, this is not as that one terrible thing happens to you or it doesn't happen to you. Because we so often are like, oh, if you weren't raped, if you weren't murdered, if your husband didn't beat you, then you escaped. And no, because that threat is all around you. And women spend their whole lives organizing around how not to be harmed, and we still barely talk about it. But we do talk about it because of this extraordinary feminist insurrection that began about 7 or 8 years ago that has been so exciting. And that for me is the real triumph in this book. Not that I found a voice and became a writer, but that we as women found voices to talk about this in a new way starting in 2012 and 13 mm-hmm. around campus rape with the Steubenville mm-hmm. case, with the rape, torture, disembowelment, murder of Jyoti Singh in New Delhi, we started to really talk about what this is and how it impacts us. So I wrote, though each incident I experienced was treated as somehow isolated and deviant, there were countless incidents, and they were of the status quo, not against or outside it. Talking about it made people uncomfortable, and mostly they responded by telling me what I was doing wrong. Some men told me they wished someone would sexually harass them because they seemed unable to imagine it as anything but pleasant invitations from attractive people. No one was offering the help of recognizing what I was experiencing or agreeing that I had the right to be safe and free. It was a kind of collective gaslighting. To live in a war that no one around me would acknowledge as a war. I am tempted to say that it made me crazy, but women are so often accused of being crazy as a way of undermining their capacity to bear witness and the reality of what they testify to. Besides, in these cases, crazy is often a euphemism for unbearable suffering. So it didn't make me crazy. It made me unbearably anxious, preoccupied, indignant, and exhausted. I was faced with either surrendering my freedom in advance or risk losing it in the worst ways imaginable. One thing that makes people crazy is being told that the experiences they have did not actually happen, that the circumstances that hem them in are imaginary, that the problems are all in their head, and that if they are distressed, it is a sign of their failure, when success would be to shut up or to cease to know what they know.
My guest is Rebecca Solnit. She was just reading from her book, Recollections of My Non-Existence. How did you become an activist?
And really, it's my wonderful little brother, speaking of other men I've written about, a good man. He became an activist, and he's not quite dyslexic, but I am what I sometimes call hyperlexic. And he kept volunteering to do the newsletter and then calling me up and saying, I volunteered to do the newsletter. And he was doing anti-war things, mm-hmm. anti-intervention in Central America. Early in the 80s, anti-nuclear stuff, and I got on board with him. I found my own path to environmental work, and then those things dovetailed and brought us both into an extraordinary era of Native American land rights activism with these Western Shoshone matriarchs in Nevada. That was a huge formative experience for me. And there was an activist history in the family. My mom did fair housing work when I was a little kid. I spent some of my afternoons riding around in the back of her station wagon with black families she was trying to get housing rights for. I had an aunt who did anti-Vietnam work and some environmental stuff. And, you know, it goes further back than that with a Irish Republican great-grandfather here in New York, and a grandfather on my father's side who was allegedly Trotsky's flag boy, but that's a whole other story. But so it's kind of in the family, but I found my own path. And my mom both could be the most male-identified, sun-worshipping person you could possibly imagine, and in her own way a feminist who was an early subscriber to Ms. Magazine. So I was given a lot, but then I found my own path, particularly towards feminism, and that took a while to find.
How did your activism affect you as a writer?
people often think of activism as spinach, this thing you do out of virtue, and oh, you're so good for doing that because surely it must be a really sucky thing to do, like, you know, eating your spinach, flossing, cleaning the toilet or something. But it allows you to find a community of idealistic people who want to change the world. And there's nothing better on earth to have than that. And these are the people who are generous. These are the people who are kind. These are the people who are visionary. But also, as somebody who felt so isolated and so powerless, to be part of communities, to be part of a group was also just such a great thing. And obviously I did it for the cause. I believe in nuclear disarmament. I believe in non-intervention in Central America. I believe in all these things. But they gave, you know, I always felt this is giving me so much more than I gave them. And in some ways the culmination, which I write about it a bit in this book, was working with these feminist matriarchs refusing to recognize that the U.S. government's actually quite illegitimate claims to own their land. And one of the big events in the book was the first time I ever moved towards violence rather than fleeing in my life. The U.S. government was coming to take away their cattle. They were ranchers and owned a herd of Mustangs and were these amazing outdoors women ranchers. And the government was about to inflict incredible violence on them. And I drove all night from San Francisco to eastern Nevada to go there. And looking back on it, that was a real landmark for me. Just whatever I've gotten from being part of a movement, I could now stand up in a whole different way because of that connection.
My guest is Rebecca Solnit. I have a couple more questions before I let you go. You know, so many people read your work when they're just discussing feminist study or just in book clubs or just want to be smarter about the world. What are you reading? What's something you are reading now or something you would think people who enjoy your work and think highly of your work might enjoy?
Well, two books that made a huge impact on me last year were Carmen Maria Machado's In the Dream House, memoir of being in a profoundly abusive same-sex relationship. So it's about incredibly ugly things told in the most beautiful and creative way possible. I'm in dialogue with her in Boston, I think, Wednesday. And it was, actually I read her book and I was like, I should have been more like Carmen. This is so great. And then another book was I Should Have Been More Like Ocean Vuong. It's a novel, but that reads very much like a memoir by Ocean Vuong called On Earth We're Briefly Gorgeous, and it is one of the most gorgeous books. He's a poet, so he really builds on the scale of the sentence, and every word and sentence is brilliant and gem-like and faceted and glows and radiates and shines and describes in such vivid, evocative ways. So those are two that both described the experience of being a queer Vietnamese refugee and first experiences of love, but also describes how we can understand ourselves, how we can describe the texture of everyday experience and interior life. And so they're both deeply personal and deeply political books and two of the best things I've read in a long time.
As you've seen the Me Too movement evolve and expand, I think people may not know, or they do know, that one of the essays you wrote sort of led to the idea of mansplaining. And as we've watched Me Too evolve, and as we watch people stand up and speak their truth and say what has happened to them and share their stories, this is the week that Harvey Weinstein is going to be sentenced.
Somebody said after some of the very bad election stuff and other news a few days ago, well, the good news is that Harvey Weinstein is in Rikers Island, which, arguably nobody should be there. But if anybody should, maybe that's the one person. So, and it is astonishing. A lot of people. I thought I was iffy about it. I don't jump to conclusions, but a lot of people couldn't believe such a powerful white man could be convicted. I will say though that what we call Me Too was just another episode in an incredible feminist opening and conversation that began in earnest in late 2012, so far as I can tell, and really happened not as the beginning of something, but the culmination of something. All the quiet work feminism had done to change how we understood how gender violence happens, why victims behave the way they do, why perpetrators do, who to trust around these things, what the statistics are. And so many more people like you were the people deciding who to talk to and, you know, who to believe, who to value, people who were TV producers and judges and lawyers and editors and legislators. And all that slow, quiet work suddenly opened up space, not because these women didn't have voices before, but because there wasn't room for people to listen to them and hear them before. So it wasn't, you know, it's never been so much about whether or not women have voices. We've always had voices, but we haven't always had places where people were willing to let us speak, or where the risks and punishments didn't outweigh the benefits of speaking. And so that's really what's changed. And I'm so grateful to more people than we'll ever be able to recognize who made it so.
Rebecca Solnit will be in conversation with Leslie Jamison at Community Bookstore, an event at the Murmur Theater, tomorrow night at 7:30 p.m. Rebecca Solnit, thank you so much for being with us today.
My pleasure. Thank you so much.